And my very first experience sitting down with a prospect, a corporate prospect, was, oh, you help kids? Yeah, whatever. Look, here's our marketing deck. Can you deliver this or not? Right. And so it was like, oh, I guess I'm just back at the same boardroom table that I was at before.
You're listening to Simon Scriver's Amazingly Ultimate Fundraising Superstar podcast, talking all things fundraising, charities, nonprofits, and more. Here's your host, as always, Simon Scriver.
Hello, and welcome to another podcast. This week has been an interesting week since I've made the decision to unsubscribe from a whole bunch of emails. So I've unsubscribed from a lot of charity newsletters. I've unsubscribed from news from a bunch of consultants, and it's all been very freeing. But one person's email came in to me just today, and I was reminded again why I'm not going to unsubscribe for it. That is my guest today, who is Chris Bayless, who sends me some of my favorite fundraising sponsorship emails, and he has very kindly come on today to talk to us. Hello, Chris. How are you?
I'm great, Simon. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. Usual. Yeah. Where are you calling from? You're over in Canada. Another Canadian guest.
Yeah, another Canadian is taking the mic. But I'm from the same town actually as my friend and podcast guest of yours, Jenny Mitchell. And so I have all the same complaints that she did, which is like minus 1,000. It's I know Jenny loves Ottawa, but I find it boring. Sorry, everyone. And we are on countdown mode. In 2 hours and 53 minutes, it's going to start snowing. And we're going to get 40 centimeters or like, I don't know, 14 or 15 inches of snow in the next 12 hours. Wow. So that's my griping for the podcast.
2 hours and 53 minutes is a very accurate weather report.
For sure. We are definitely accurate when it comes to our wretched weather in Ottawa.
Well, I've only bumped into you a few times in Toronto because, you know, you're all over the place. So you do a lot of work in Canada and the US. What do you do, Chris? What's your job?
So I suppose at the heart of it, I'm a consultant in the sponsorship space, but we've niched, or for our American friends, niched very, very, very narrowly to just to the sponsorship valuation space. And so really what I do is, in particular in Canada and the United States, I help folks figure out what their sponsorship opportunities are worth in a way, I suppose, that's kind of defensible to sponsors to justify return on investment on their sponsorship. So that end, and that alone, is really what our main focus is. And there's, you know, a couple of steps that go into that, but that's where we make our home.
And when you say we, you're talking about the name you guys work under, the Sponsorship Collective.
Yeah, you got it. Yeah, we're a small but mighty team in Ottawa. And you know, I was mentioning to you before we kicked off that we're now incorporated in the United States. And proud owner of a Delaware Corp because it's the lowest state taxes in the United States.
Why else would you go to Delaware?
You got it. But our office will not be in Delaware, I assure you. But so next step is to expand to the United States. So we're small but mighty, and loving what we do.
Very nice. So I started the podcast by saying that your emails, I love your emails. And actually, in terms of sponsorships and proposals to companies and interacting with companies, I've learned over the years so much from you. And you are a guy that strikes me as really generous with your knowledge. And we've talked about this a few times, the amount of stuff that you put out for free and the amount of information you put in terms of trying to educate the sector in terms of how to approach corporates. Genuinely, I think it's second to none. I think when it comes to sponsorship, you're my favorite and the biggest wealth of information out there.
Well, that is very, very kind of you, and I take that as a great compliment coming from you, because I think many would accuse you of the same thing, of being incredibly helpful. But I think, and what I like about your stuff so much is just how honest you are, and I try to at least maybe take a page from your book when it comes to the honesty factor on the sponsorship side. So I certainly appreciate it and will happily take that compliment.
That's let's stop being so nice to each other, because let's instead attack and criticize companies. Anyone who follows me knows I'm kind of cynical about the private sector. I'm cynical about companies. What's your thoughts on it? I mean, you've obviously probably seen some pretty shady people, some pretty weird companies, some pretty bad decisions. Does it make you cynical working all around sponsorship all the time?
Yeah, so it's interesting because, you know, I'll start by saying my view on the corporate approach to the charitable sector is agnostic. I don't have an official position or make judgment but I will answer your actual question. But because their goal is exclusively and purely, unapologetically perhaps, to make money. And none of us want to pay too much for goods, so we expect the companies we purchase from to be good with their money. But then when we approach those companies for money, we say, well, they have so much, they should give us some. So we hold this dichotomy, we hold this dissonance in a way in the charitable sector. But I will say though that you know, what I think of the corporate approach to profit and perhaps the structures we live in, I have no official comment on. however, I will answer your question that cynicism without question, absolutely. And so when I came to the sector, when I say the sector, I mean the charitable sector, not-for-profit sector, I came mm-hmm. from being a sponsor. No one called me that. I worked in corporate sales, but I had a sponsorship budget. Mm-hmm. And I came to the charitable sector thinking, enough of this corporate greed. I just want to make a difference. So I'm going to come and I'm going to work in corporate fundraising way back in the early 2000s, just before, you know, a giant recession. And my very first experience sitting down with a prospect, a corporate prospect, was, oh, you help kids? Yeah, whatever. Look, here's our marketing deck. Can you deliver this or not? Right. And so it was like, oh, I guess I'm just back at the same boardroom table that I was at before. Mm. So I would say that it is absolutely the case that to work on the sponsorship side, which I'm deliberately differentiating from the corporate philanthropy side, the sponsorship side, which frankly is where all the money is, you need a thick skin. And I often tell people that your cause is in fact irrelevant. And I think that makes them uncomfortable, and perhaps it should. So cynical, yes, but we want money for our causes. And so that forces us to be cynical, sure, but also we have to be realists and work with what we got.
Yeah, and I think there's a thin line between cynicism and being realistic. And when it comes to corporates, all it is, I suppose, acknowledging what they're actually looking for. Yeah. And I think where we kind of, you know, where it can get frustrating in this is thinking that companies maybe have a heart. Yeah. And if you try and tap into a company's emotions, if you try and, you know, appeal to their better nature, you're very quickly reminded that companies aren't people. They're inanimate objects who have to make a profit.
Yeah, that's right. And in some cases in the United States, I would say mostly they're legally obligated to do so. They have a legal obligation to their shareholders. So even if the CEO, for example, has a heart and personally gives to a charity of his or her choice, it's still a challenge to get them to line up their corporate giving in the same way, or at least their sponsorship. And so, yeah, I think it's fair to say that companies don't have a heart. Whether or not it's fair to say they have malintent, some do, but mm-hmm. my advice to my clients and my colleagues out there is just avoid those companies. Mm-hmm. Don't do business with companies who are bad, and don't do business with companies who can harm you or your brand. And the good news is there's really not that many of those types of companies out there practicing what we call cause sponsorship. Mm-hmm. You know, tobacco company giving to Canadian Cancer Society. What a terrible idea. And that's why neither of them engage in that practice, at least not. I don't know if they ever did, but they certainly don't now. And the real key to finding out what companies are acceptable to work with, in my view, is audience data. If your donors regularly make particular types of purchases, then you could say comfortably that you have an implicit blessing from your donors that those types of companies are acceptable ethically.
I mean, those are some of the companies we'd be looking for if you're a nonprofit. Is you're looking for I suppose, companies whose customers cross over with your donor base. There's some for sure. some sort of overlap there that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, donor base, or if you're running events, I would say you're the attendees to those events. You know, basically your audience, the people who are engaging with you. And this is why a lot of what I write about, a lot of the work we do with our clients involves audience data and audience analysis to know, you know, does your database have a problem with extractives, have a problem with I don't know, international corporations? Do they have a problem with I don't know, automotive or pharmaceutical? And often we've been surprised to when we just ask the donors, hey, should we take money from a pharmaceutical company? In some cases, the answer is a resounding yes, and in others, it's a resounding no. And that can help give guidance from a practical perspective. Whether or not that fits with your own internal ethical guidelines is a different story, but it stands to reason that if your donors and your event attendees are purchasing products from a particular company, that can be a like a secondary way to determine whether or not that company's values are in line with yours, in that you share an audience.
That's interesting, because we a lot of the time we're trying to second guess what people will think and make assumptions, as opposed to just asking donors and event attendees.
Yeah, I'm never a fan of making decisions on behalf of your donors or making assumptions on behalf of your attendees, and definitely not a fan of making assumptions on behalf of your corporate partners. That is a risky practice, we could say.
Yeah, well, in terms of making assumptions about companies, I think we've all been guilty of that sometimes, assuming what they want. And one of the interesting things you always talk about is sending in a proposal to companies where we make these assumptions, you know. So if you're sending the same proposal to 100 different companies, or if you've written your proposal even before you speak to them, what you're doing is making a big old assumption there, aren't you? I think it's one of your posts where you said in your first meeting with the company, you're not bringing a proposal, you're bringing a blank page.
Yeah, you got it. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the way. And I, you know, and if we reflect on ourselves as consumers, and ultimately what we're asking our sponsors to be is customers of ours, to give us money in exchange for real benefit in the marketplace, not aligning themselves with a quote, a good cause. Every cause is a good cause for the most part. But in the subjective sense, really every cause is a good cause to someone. But when we're reaching out to our corporate prospects, we have to think of them as a customer. It's a business to business sale that you're engaging in. And so if you walked on a car lot, and someone said, the minute you walked on that car lot, someone handed you a contract to purchase a Honda Civic, just because that's the car they hope to sell. It's not a good sales approach. It's not a good sales strategy. If they probe a little more and find out why you're there, they might find out that you're this sad guy that lives in Ottawa and you need a snowblower, or that or that you have 12 kids and you need a Honda Pilot. And it starts by asking questions, not by trying to sell the thing that you wish people wanted. And when we create these gold, silver, bronze packages, even if we change the name, what we're telling our sponsors, our corporate partners, our prospects, is that this is the only way to engage with us. Nice. And I'll tell you, the biggest deals that I've worked on personally, that I personally sold, the biggest deals that I've worked on, we never had a sponsorship package at all. It never, ever entered the equation. And most of my clients negotiate probably for 6 months or more before creating a sponsorship package. And the only reason they're making that is to justify the decision to the finance guys and gals. So we place a tremendous amount of emphasis on the sponsorship package. We treat it like a direct mail campaign, but actually you really don't need a package at all.
And I mean, obviously, like most people, when they hear that, not most people, but some people's not objection to it, but concern, that's time consuming. What would you say to someone who says, well, you know, that's much more time consuming than sending out a proposal to the same proposal to 100 different people?
I agree with them. They're absolutely right. The problem is 100 proposals out the door might bring in $50,000. And so let's say it took you, I don't know, 10 hours. So it's $5,000 an hour. But instead, you spent that same 10 hours or 100 hours or whatever on doing a well-researched, highly cultivated, discovery-based approach. And that turned into a multi-year deal of $800,000 a year, which is literally what a client of mine just closed for their major national event. 800K a year for 5 years.
Wow.
The value per hour spent in year one was like hundreds of thousands. And then by year two or three, where they don't have to close the gift anymore, it's significant profit. So the question, my reaction to that kind of tongue in cheek is, you can get to no very quickly in the sponsorship game, or you can get to yes slowly, but you can't combine them. You can't get to yes fast. So if your goal is to log, if you're measuring packages out the door, then just make packages and send them out. But if your goal is to achieve budget, then in a particular budget and achieve, and ultimately achieve your mission, then the sponsor package isn't going to do it. And we have to think of sponsorship in the same way we approach major gifts. If nobody sends out a direct mail campaign, I hope, and expect someone to write $1 million check back because they just really loved how the copy, right? Like that's the bottom of the donor pyramid, in so much as that's still relevant. For a reason. And so when you're doing sponsorship, you need to be talking to someone in the way that you would major gifts. And is it more time consuming? Of course. But that's what the discipline demands. And that is one of the truths, I suppose, the indisputable truths of sponsorship.
So is that, I mean, I'm guessing that's a common thing you see. You work with a lot of different clients all around North America. And so you're seeing, is that one of the common mistakes you're seeing people do? Is trying to go for this big blanket approach to as many companies as possible with no connection, rather than drilling down a bit and trying to find a stronger connection?
Without question, yeah. So there's mistake number one, or common, I'd say more common practice number one, which doesn't result in success, is, and there's all kinds of reasons that we do these things. None of which are related to the intelligence or ability or drive of these individuals. I think we have a major resource problem in our sector. I think we have a major time problem in our sector. And there's all kinds of reasons for it. The problem is justification for bad sponsorship isn't enough to warrant sponsorship, right? You still have to, you're competing with sport, university, municipalities. So yeah, I'd say common practice number one is debates, meetings, committee meetings, revisions, reviews to create sponsorship packages that are then fired at the door. That's mistake number one. Mistake or common practice number two is intense focus on the cause. 28 pages, 27.75 pages are on the cause. And the quarter page is fill this out, send me a check, and we'll give you one of these levels at the back of the sponsorship package. Those two together are lethal.
And you've said, I mean, you've said something which I guess some people would find kind of controversial, is that these companies, they don't care about your cause.
That's right. And so, you know, in part I say that because I want to jar people. The companies don't care about your cause in the way we think they do. Mm-hmm. So your mission, your vision is important in that it attracts a particular audience. Your sponsors, your prospects, of course, there are no such thing as sponsors. They're only businesses who use sponsorship, which is a marketing tool, to get more customers. So your vision, your mission can attract your target market, which happens to be the target market of a prospect. But we kind of shortcut that and say, we're going to grant wishes, so Lexus give us money. And Lexus says, well, we have to sell 28 cars this quarter. And you say, well, that's great. If you gave us 50K, we could grant this many wishes. The part you're missing is that 40-year-old high net worth moms who live in the suburbs, who drive Lexus or Mercedes, have two or more kids, and those kids play football. That's the target market, potentially, of Lexus. And if you can prove that that target market cares more about your cause than any other, now you have a license to print money. But we miss that part. We skip that part and hope Lexus figures out that you can help them achieve their target market. But Lexus has the whole world to choose from to get in front of that audience. They can go to other conferences, activities, events, sporting events. They can engage in direct mail, social media. They don't actually need you. All they want is access to audience and a way to measure whether or not that access was successful. And so that to me is the most challenging I don't know, theory or philosophy to get over, to embrace in the sector right now.
So in sponsorship, a lot of the time we compete with other nonprofits, but I suppose more than that, you're competing with they could be spending their budget on social media, on TV, like you said, sports events, other events which are not nonprofit or which are for profit.
That's right.
And so the competition is all around us, and we have to make ourselves the best offering.
Yeah. So we do this interesting thing, I think, in the charitable sector, where we look at our donors as one dimensional. They're our donors. They give us money. Therefore, their only sense of identity is that they're donors to this organization. But we forget that after they've made their donation, they go and watch, if they're me, the Montreal Canadiens play hockey, because the Ottawa Senators are arguably the worst hockey team maybe in the history of the sport. But that maybe that's debatable. So when I go to see the Montreal Canadiens play, I engage in pizza activations and free t-shirt giveaways and all these things. So by morning, I was a donor. But in the evening, I'm a ravenous Montreal Canadiens fan. And then I sit down with my wife and we watch whatever comic book Netflix TV show we can possibly find. And so if you step back and think about what someone in my position who has the kind of business I do, who lives in the community I live in, we're more than just the causes we donate to. And so I think we forget about that in the charitable sector, that actually individuals are more complicated than just the donation or the event they attended. And sponsors, companies already know this to be true. So they can access me at an AFP event, of which I attend many. They can access me on the board of my favorite charity. They can access me through direct marketing, through social media, through commercials, through product placement on The Punisher, which I'm watching right now, or when I arrive at the Bell Center, named after Bell Canada, a telecom company here in Canada. They can access me there. So a sponsor has the choice of many, many, many different avenues to get at their target market. And what we're offering in the charitable sector is one interesting and actually, I would say, the most powerful access point to the audience. But we have to step out of this idea that our donors believe something kind of homogenous and that we're competing with other similar caused charities. Actually, the competition is way more fierce outside of the charitable sector. And we're in that space if we want to practice sponsorship.
What makes you say, I'm gonna skip over the fact that you talked about pizza activation, and instead I'm gonna ask you what makes you say that the charitable sector is one of the most interesting ways? Why doesn't it make it any better, or more relevant to potential customers?
Yeah, a lot better, in fact. So and here's why: I buy a ticket to go see the Canadiens play. I expect a very specific experience, a very specific service. I also expect my team to win, which they do at an above average rate. But I expect certain things from my experience, and I'm purchasing a product. When I donate to my favorite charity, that's my part of my activism. That's how I express myself in this world. That's how I make change, because maybe I don't have the ability to be frontline with homeless youth in Ottawa or in Canada, but this organization does, and they share my values, and I see myself in them. So when a company stands up and says, you know what, Chris, we believe in that too, you can absolutely bet that when I see a company stand up for what I believe in and support what I believe in, that they're top of the list when I'm about to make a purchase. Now, that all sounds very philosophical, very nice, and very fluffy without data. Well, here's the data. we've probably surveyed 3 or 4 million Canadians, probably 5 or 6 million Americans, a handful of Australians, and asked them the question, if a company supports not any cause, but this cause, this organization, would you make a different purchase? Would you purchase their product? And we typically see responses in the 87 to 96% rate. Say, you know, if I'm considering Honda or Toyota and Honda supports my cause, I will test drive a Honda. So I run a conference this spring. We have Ipsos Marketing coming to talk about what Canadians believe and what they expect of their companies, and they do the testing and stats Canada wide as well, and we've seen similar results. Hmm. Now let me ask you something: the last time you drove by and saw a billboard for McDonald's, did you immediately pull in and purchase a Big Mac at the next McDonald's?
No, conversion
rates are tiny when you talk about marketing. Click-through rates on a social media campaign, if you get 2%, you're the greatest marketer who ever lived. You're a millionaire overnight if you get a 2% click-through rate on social media marketing. But to say to a company, this is who our audience is, this is your target market, we know the brands that they prefer, we know the purchases they're going to make, and we can influence that purchasing decision. No one can do that better than the charitable sector. No one. And we've pulled the data. We've seen it. We know this to be true. And so by focusing on cause, we miss this huge opportunity that you can influence buying decisions. Whether or not you want to is a very different conversation. But the reality is, you work with a company, it's seen as an endorsement, and people are changing buying decisions as a result.
Yeah. I mean, what's the ethics of that? If you're, you know, I mean, sometimes I kind of joke that companies, any company with money is a company who's making the world a worse place. They're like, you know, the companies that are profitable are the ones that we're kind of cleaning up the mess from. Yeah. So, you know, that's a bit black and white of a view, but what are the ethics there of us influencing supporters, you know, supporters who are emotional, who care about, you know, making the world a better place, who are invested in it and from the heart, and there's something in there about us pushing them towards a Big Mac.
So my thoughts are this. I have a couple, and something that I've really struggled with personally in this sector, personally with my, it's less so with my business now because it's ultimately an extension of who I am and my belief system. But as a fundraiser, it was one of the most challenging things I had to do to politically say or to say about my politics, about my belief system in general, that it's not up to me to speak for my constituents, that being the donors and the event attendees. Mm-hmm. And unless the charity is an extension of, you know, you and your politics or your worldview, let's say, politics is a bit of a loaded term, but I'm not sure if it's appropriate to make those decisions on behalf of our donors and event attendees if, and only if, this is the qualifier, they disagree with you. And so this is the challenging part, right? Because if your medical association, and I have a background in selling sponsorship for medical associations and lots of kids' health charities, and you say this, we support this brand of, yogurt or cheese or whatever, and people interpret that as you saying it's healthier cheese or healthier broccoli, then you are in fact manipulating the public in exchange for money. And I think that's, I don't think that's a good practice. And in fact, it should be avoided. You know how they had the like healthy heart menu and all these scandals kind of came about because they found out people weren't really doing it. I don't know if it was a healthy heart, but you know, similar programs where it was like, turned out people weren't doing any real testing to see if the food was actually healthier. Right? Disastrous. Don't do that. But if your audience tells you, we're going to buy a Honda Civic or a Toyota, whatever the equivalent is in Toyota, or a Ford Focus, we're going to make this purchase in the next 18 months. I think if Toyota is willing to say, we believe in supporting organizations that protect the environment, and we're going to invest in those organizations, I think those people who are trying to make the right buying decision, I think they should know which of the companies are willing to put their money where their mouth is and perhaps believe what they believe. This is definitely not social change fundraising. This is not changing the if you're an environmentalist, the core problem, right? Which is fossil fuel consumption. I had a professor who said the problem isn't the internal combustion engine, it's individualism. Everyone wants to own a car. But like, you know, you're not solving any of those problems. But if your constituency is going to buy a car anyway, then you can help them make the choice for perhaps a more responsible organization because they believe in what your audience believes in. So it's complex, and I think ultimately, if your ethics don't sit well with how I'm framing sponsorship, my advice is don't practice it. Stick to major gifts. Stay out of the sponsorship game, because that direct connection to those companies who you may see as manipulative or inappropriate or whatever, it's very direct. But you know, I had a conversation with a good friend of mine, Kathy Mann, on her podcast. It's coming out soon. And the conversation was, and I said to her, but what about your major gift donors, those people who are giving you significant dollars? Do you check their investments to make sure they're not investing in those very same companies, right? Like, do you know their wealth didn't come from that? You're one step removed, but you're still basically participating in that same core dilemma, right? Which is perhaps these organizations that are causing the problems you're trying to solve are then using charity to sell more of those products.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, if what I've described as maybe our shared cynical view of corporations, I'll still commit to formally being agnostic, but you know, if that cynical view is the correct view for your organization, don't take money from corporations. That is really the cleanest approach. It could mean that you won't achieve your mission. It could mean that your competitor will take the money. And you've stopped nothing, but I think ethics aren't really, I don't think you base ethics on the outcome. You base ethics on the right decision.
Yeah. There's that pressure sometimes, you know, it can be easier just to take the money or not ask the questions.
Yes.
Just go down that easy road. And I think especially for, you know, this maybe smaller and medium organizations who are, they don't come from a sales background. They don't have, you know, fundraising knowledge necessarily. They're there because they care about the cause.
Yes.
And suddenly here's a check for, you know, 10,000, which is going to help a whole lot of puppies. It's easier to not ask the questions. It's easier to say yes sometimes.
Yeah, for sure. And I think when you do corporate, when you do sponsorship, there's nothing subtle about that relationship. You're telling the world that at the very least, we think it's acceptable to take money from these individuals, from these corporations, or outright, we endorse this corporation as ethical, responsible, et cetera. But again, I always go back to the audience data. You may say, we don't believe that, I don't know, sugary drinks, Coca-Cola or Pepsi is a healthy decision. Mm-hmm. Yet 87% of your database actually drinks Coke or Pepsi. You know, so should you take money from Coke or Pepsi or shouldn't you? But there's a lack of alignment between your core audience and your belief system. And so my default has always been, obviously, if you're in the human rights space, without question need an ethical code that guides what you think is human rights abuses in the companies that you may be working with. And then, once you have that in place, the next step is to turn to your audience and say, what do you plan to purchase? And we also ask, we usually give maybe 20 categories of companies and say, which of these companies do you think is a good fit for us as a charity? And which do you think is a bad fit? So that our donors, our stakeholders can tell us, we don't think you should take money from, you know, from extractives, from pharmaceuticals, from whomever. And we basically leave the choice in many cases to our audience.
That's clever, because that's an amazing thing to actually bring to a company and say, our stakeholders think we should take money from you.
Yes. Yeah. And so there definitely been cases in the sponsorship world where the sponsorship seeker made the wrong decision. They went with, I think it was Budweiser for a Canadian event. And of course, you know, anyone outside of the United States seems to be aware that that's just kind of like water to them, right? Like, it's not really beer. And so, although it's a wonderful product, just in case.
Podcast is brought to you by Budweiser. Please ignore Chris's comments.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, I think any self-respecting Western European and Canadian we like a stronger beer. And so I'm pretty sure it was Budweiser or like Bush Light or something came to this event, and they started doing social listening, and everyone in the audience was basically trash talking this company, this beer company. And so they realized very quickly that this was the wrong move. This was the wrong decision. And so you can insulate against that by reaching out to your audience and saying, they love light beer. You know, if you were to ask that question, they can't get enough of it. So you're safe if you work with us. But then there's also the idea that the people who are coming to your event, if they would like you to have certain types of food, maybe they prefer vegan food, or maybe they're all like obligate carnivores and they prefer nothing but steak. But if you ask them first, then you can create an event that not only will not be offensive to them, but that they'll actually love enough to give more money to come back and to refer a friend. Mm. And so we call that activation in the sponsorship space. You ask your audience what they want more of and you give it to them. You ask them what they despise and you try to alleviate that challenge for them. Mm. And so on the one hand, it's a good prospecting tool because you can say, look, our audience is comfortable with pharmaceuticals. Many audiences are not comfortable with pharmaceuticals. Mm. So many international development organizations, their audiences do not want mining and extractives, et cetera. But we've had one client whose database actually didn't have a problem with extractives. And it was odd because they were an indigenous or Aboriginal rights group, and extractives in Canada. And
wow.
Yeah, right. It's problematic.
Yeah,
but this audience was like, no, it's okay.
That's so weird.
It's very weird. Yeah. And the organization said, we're still not doing it because it's not in line with our ethics, our core.
Yeah,
ethics.
Yeah.
We just can't be seen to be working with these orgs.
Yeah.
So asking your audience is incredibly important. Recognizing that you're still the expert in the industry, so that means you don't have to do what your audience says, equally important. But often my clients are shocked when they hear from their audience that many of them are planning, say, a home renovation, mm-hmm. and they had never even considered reaching out to Home Depot or Lowe's or whomever.
Wow. Yeah, I suppose if your audience is saying, yes, it's fine, then that's kind of easier to ignore than if your audience is saying, no, don't touch that. I think if your audience is objecting to something, then we have to tread really, really carefully.
So I had this pro bono client they were a women's rights org, very small. They dealt with victims of sexual assault, and they they still hold, I just don't work with them anymore, an overtly radical feminist worldview, like enshrined in their mission and vision. So you can imagine how popular they would be to most corporations, given what I just said. And so we surveyed the audience, and lo and behold, we discovered a couple of things about the audience's buying behaviors. And so we reached out to those companies and said, you don't have to go public about supporting a radical feminist organization. That's not what we're asking you to do. But these women who, as it turns out, they were mostly women in the database, they care very much about this organization and the work it does. And they're influencers, and they make business-to-business buying decisions. They want this event that they're holding to be a success. So why don't you do a match, double all the revenue that comes in?
Mm.
And they said, we'll do you one better. We'll give you our space for free so you don't have expenses, and then we'll match. And so the company had nothing at all to do with radical feminism, nothing at all to do with women's rights. It was just a company that sold widgets, but they were really interested in the audience. You don't have to find mission alignment. You find audience alignment, and very kind of openly and honestly, we went, so this is our mission, this is what we do. This is why people don't like us in the media. This is why, them in the media is an entirely female based organization. I was just doing some consulting and so they were very, very successful. And I would say they probably had the least attractive cause, when we describe it in terms of sponsorship, of anyone I've worked with. And they killed it. They did an incredible job by staying audience-centric.
Wow, that makes a lot of sense. I'm curious, I don't want to keep you too much longer, but I'm curious, if you take off your sponsorship hat which is a hard thing to do, I imagine. But as a member of the public, when was the last time you saw something that made a lot of sense to you that you thought, oh, actually, you know, that's a good partnership there?
Yeah. So, you know, I've been really thinking a lot about this, and I'm almost nervous to even bring it up because of the backlash that Gillette has received as a result of their, I think, the best a man can get.
Yeah.
In the commercial, you've heard about the, so in, maybe it's just a North American phenomenon, but it was like they're kind of announcing their connection to the Me Too movement.
Yeah.
And talking about kind of some of the atrocities and, or at least inappropriate behavior, I'd say, committed by men throughout history. So they took this, they made this commercial, this stance, and then they just got clobbered in the marketplace. And all of the clobbering came from, mostly from men saying, I'll never, you know, I'm not going to buy this product anymore. How dare they talk to me about what's masculinity and toxic masculinity, all these things. It created this fascinating dialogue.
Yeah, people burning their razors on YouTube. And stuff
like yeah, that. Totally. Yeah. So like absolute, I think most people would look at that as a completely and utterly disastrous marketing campaign to sell razors to men.
Yeah.
But then I got to thinking, and I actually read this article that was about the Gillette commercial, and they said that Gillette has traditionally marketed to men, but women buy razors and products, and the Gillette products that sell to women are actually heavily pink taxed. They're way more expensive than men. So they posited perhaps they're just trying to actually grow their female market share with this commercial. And I thought, if that's true, I mean, now we're getting highly cynical here, but if that's true, what a brilliant move on the part of Gillette.
Yeah.
But I thought, to me, that, you know, regardless of what you think of the core message or whether you're comfortable with the message or your reaction to the commercial, they call it a short film, I think. I thought the dialogue that created, the eyeballs that it drew to the campaign, the number of dislikes on YouTube. I think they're like number 25th most disliked video in history on YouTube. And it's taken up a lot of the cause marketing, cause sponsorship space because, well, they are in fact connected with a cause, but mostly it's about an issue. And so I actually thought that was incredibly well done from a marketing perspective and to cut through the clutter. So to me, that stands out.
It was an interesting one, that one, because sometimes you see these mistakes that companies make and you feel like, okay, they've clearly bumbled into this. They haven't thought about it. They're just ignorant. But there was something about that campaign where they must have known, you know, there's going to be this backlash from that side of it because of the subject line. So you feel like, okay, maybe they actually know what they were doing in this sense. And it's right. I mean, I wonder, off the top of my head, I wonder what the stats are on women buying their razors. Probably more of them are buying because you see men with their shitty razors that they don't replace just sitting there. Whereas you never see a woman letting it get to that point.
Also, as a fellow bearded man, at least the last time I saw you, there's a trend right now where men are just not shaving as much.
Yeah.
So, whether or not this is just a clever and devious marketing ploy or which is where I actually think, what I think it is, or whether or not it's, I can't be a fence sitter on everything, I suppose, or whether or not Gillette just has this sudden conscience and they're interested in women's rights or at least how men and women interact with each other. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, but I think I saw lots of videos of women saying men are burning their razors. Well, I just went out and bought all this Gillette stuff, right? Like trying to counteract them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, but what I think is interesting is compare that to the next time you go to buy something at, I don't know, Walmart, and someone says, do you want to buy this pinup for $1 to go to a local charity? I bet you've been asked that 1,000 times in your life. And I bet you can't remember even one charity that money was going to.
Yeah.
I can, because I worked on the Toys R Us Starlight Children's Foundation, like $2 million a year campaign or $1.5 million. But most people don't know. But if I say, hey, did you see that Gillette commercial? Everybody knows what I'm talking about. So
yeah, and look at Toys R Us now.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, we're filing for bankruptcy protection. So, I think from a perhaps an awareness perspective, a conversation perspective, that was the most fascinating thing that I had seen. You know, when I think about, was it the like Oscars or something, the water bottle fiasco, or the lady who was giving out samples was like photobombing everybody at the you know, that I think that's just stupid. But the Gillette commercial, maybe this isn't how they expected it to happen, but boy, oh boy, did they make some waves.
Oh, that's interesting. All right, okay, I'm going to start to wrap this up, but maybe if there was one or two things that you would say, obviously all your clients are very different, but I'd say there's some trends there. What's the one or two things you'd like people to take away from this? What should they be doing differently?
Yeah, so, I mean, ultimately, if you want to be successful, and if you define success as sponsorship dollars from companies, then the very first thing I recommend that you do is, if you can do this and keep your job, throw out your sponsorship packages. If you can't, then just leave your sponsorship package in the office. Make one. If your boss tells you you have to, if your board tells you, make one. Keep a job. But before you give a proposal to anybody, just go have a conversation with them. Talk to them about what their goals are. Be laser focused on what their goals are, not about your cause, not about the cool pictures, the kids you help, the animals you help. Pretend you're a sports team and you don't actually do any good in the world, unless you're the Montreal Canadiens. Then sit down with your prospect and ask them their goals before you do that. So that is the biggest change you should make in your fundraising process. But before you do that, start to get to know who your audience is, what they want, build a profile of who that audience is. Send me an email if you'd like, and I will give you our survey questions that we ask with our clients. Nothing we do is top secret proprietary stuff. Like, we literally just ask 21 questions, and that's been enough to sell multi-million dollar sponsorship deals. Shoot me an email, I'll send you the survey, and you can do it yourself. You've got to get to know your audience, what they're after. You've got to engage your prospects without the sponsorship package. And the third piece is, you have to stop guessing at what your opportunities are worth. You absolutely must do evaluation. You have to, or you are getting taken advantage of if you don't have evaluation. Simon and I got good and cynical on this call. But I can say without any hesitation, if you don't know the market value of your opportunity, you're being taken advantage of. And I wrote like a 4,000 word blog post on how to do valuations. It's on my blog. It's my second most visited blog post. Go read it and implement it. Those three things are enough to take you to the top 1% of the sponsorship game in the charitable sector.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, and I'd say, I mean, there's so much we haven't touched on here. So I'd say the fourth thing is to go and read some of your stuff, because, you know, every blog post, there's a huge learning in it. You're so generous with resources like those 21 questions, like the valuation stuff, everything you push out there. So where do people find you? What's your website?
Sponsorshipcollective.com.
Nice.
Yeah. Nice. So yeah, look me up. I promise you there's a ton of, I think at last count, I was at 250,000 words. Just in blog posts alone. I also do a webinar pretty regularly, a free webinar pretty regularly, where we go through some of these ideas in detail. And there's lots of other ways that you can connect with me, but the best way is to go to my website. You get a little pop-up saying, give me your email address. Simon already said it's worth it. So give me your email address and I will hammer you with knowledge, I promise.
Yeah, it never feels like hammering, but yeah, I'll put a link in the podcast description for everyone. I really genuinely recommend signing up to Chris's mailing list. The stuff you get from that, the free stuff you get from that, will change your sponsorship and all your corporate fundraising. It's good stuff, so I'll link to it. So yeah, Chris, thanks for giving us a bit of time. There's so much more to say, but I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to speak to us.
Anytime. Absolute pleasure.
Excellent. And we'll see you again soon. I hope I see you in Canada soon or somewhere else.
Next time you're in town, I do not recommend Ottawa for 9 months of the year, but next time you're in Canada, let me know.
Yeah, you can take me to a Montreal game.
Well, let's meet in Montreal or Toronto. I'll even give you Vancouver, but Ottawa's not recommended out of July and August.
Really sorry. You're not going to be closing the deal with that Ottawa Tourism Board anytime soon.
Yeah, lawsuit with Ottawa Tourism.
All right, Chris, thanks a million. We'll talk to you again soon. Take care.
Sounds good.
You've been listening to Simon Scriver's Amazingly Ultimate Fundraising Superstar Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and head over to changefundraising.com to learn more or get in touch with Simon. Or don't, whatever, you're big enough to make your own decisions.
Hello, this is Morgan Freeman. For discounts on Simon's best-selling online fundraising courses, go to www.changefundraising.com/training and use coupon code podcast. Complete them in your own time, wherever you want. Get busy living or get busy buying.